It's time for the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug DeFeller. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Paul. How you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful. It's beautiful here in Orange County. I was taking a little walk around the studio at my lunch break, and wonderful here. I don't know. Somebody's going to listen to this a year from now, 5 years from now, and it'll be awful and miserable on that day. They say, what are they talking about here? But today, it's wonderful.
Hey, and the good news is they're going to still be listening to us 5 years from now.
Isn't that amazing? You know, you've been on now, what, 4 years?
6 years.
6 years. Oh, my goodness. And yeah. I'll bet, I'm going to go Google, I'll bet if we looked at some of the episodes, I know that when you were doing some with, you had a co-host there earlier, and when you were doing them together, I looked at one of those shows, somebody listened to it like within the last 3-4 weeks or something. I mean, these things live on for years. So think carefully. Choose your words carefully today. These are going to live on forever here.
Oh, man, now I'm nervous. Okay, well, look, welcome to today's episode of The Coaching Perspective. And our topic for today is, how did you end up loving your work? Or how do you end up loving your work? Yeah. Well, look, before we get to that, if you're listening to our podcast, then thanks for visiting our website, thecoachingperspective.com. Be sure to check out our archives for some of our other shows with some great guests from the past. And speaking of guests, if you would like to be on the show, we're always looking for coaches, CEOs, and HR professionals to interview. Just send me an email, doug@thecoachingperspective.com, and I might just tell you we are booked through August, September. Our next openings are in October, and we have part of November booked. So, hey, if you want to be on the show, you better get a hold of me. And if you've gotten a hold of me in the past and you haven't heard from me, I probably lost it. You better do it all over again. If I wasn't interested, I would have responded. So if you've heard nothing, get back to me. Well, look, if you've missed any of our past shows, you can also go, besides our website, you can go to our Podbeam site. That's dgefeller, D-G-F-E-L-L-E-R, .podbeam.com. So that's where you can find what we're doing and what we've done. You know, we had a great show last week. We had Lois Carson Hunter talking about making things better at work and sharing her unshackled leadership tips and traits, and also sharing with us the service that she performed serving on the Executive Coaches of Orange County, a nonprofit organization for helping nonprofit boards and providing coaching services and consulting for them. So that's great. If you're looking for something to do after our show tonight, well, tonight's the local ICF Orange County chapter meeting. That was not what our director had in mind here, but I could see. Anyhow, it's the meeting. It's at the Wyndham Hotel. It'll be another great monthly meeting with a very entertaining guest speaker. So, okay, so how did we get to this topic? How do you end up loving your work? Well, you know, it all started with my looking into the discussion blogs on some of the coaching websites, and one thing that caught my eye was a video by Cal Newport claiming that following your passions was bad advice. Now, follow your passion, bad advice. I mean, that kind of woke me up. Anyhow, I had to watch the video. It was so intriguing. I then bought his book, which is titled So Good They Can't Ignore You. That was really interesting. Of course, that read to my leading an article by Mike Rowe. Anybody know who Mike Rowe is? Yeah, you do. Mike Rowe, Discovery Channel, and the Dirty Jobs host. That's who he is. He's the guy that has gone all around the country, interviewed hundreds of people with jobs that you and I just don't want to do, and then performed them himself. And so he had some interesting thoughts. All of that, and you know, this is the internet at its best or at its worst. You start out with one little bit of research, and the next thing you know, you're off and never land on everything else. Anyhow, all of that caused me to want to have this conversation with you today. And the questions that I want to kind of pose in this dialogue is follow your passion bad advice? Is it for everyone, and why? And the second question, what is the key to being happy with or loving your work? Is it possible, and how do you get there? So Let me start out by paraphrasing part of a blog from Mike Rowe that sort of goes like this. And again, really great, interesting blog. Google Mike Rowe, R-O-W-E, and his blog will pop up. And very, very interesting. Anyhow, a reader writes into him and says, you know, I spent the last year trying to figure out the right career for myself, and I still can't figure out what to do. I've always been a hands-on kind of guy and a go-getter. I could never be an office worker. I need change, excitement, and adventure in my life, but where the pay is steady. I grew up in construction, and my first job was a restoration project. I loved everything outdoors. I play music for extra money. I like trying pretty much anything or everything, but get bored very easily. I want a career that will always keep me happy, but can allow me to have a family and get some time to travel. And I figure if anyone knows jobs, it's you. So I was wondering what your thoughts are on this. And, you know, if you can get the time, please respond. Thank you very much. Well, Mike responds. Now, I'm going to admit a good portion of his response because he goes into this this really funny joke. But it doesn't have a lot to do with what we're saying. So I kind of pick up in the middle of his response. And Mike says to the reader, hey, consider your own words. You don't want a career, you want the right career. You need excitement and adventure, but not at the expense of stability. You want lots of change and the freedom to travel, but you need the certainty of steady pay. You talk about being easily bored, although boredom is out of your control, as though boredom is out of your control. It isn't. Boredom is a choice, like tardiness or interrupting. Hey, it's one thing to love the outdoors, but you take it a step further. You vow to never take an office job. You talk about the needs of your family, even though that family doesn't exist yet. And finally, you say the career you described must always make you happy. Well, reader, these are my thoughts. You may choose to ignore them, and I wouldn't blame you. But since you asked, and here's the punchline, stop looking for the right career and start looking for a job, any job. Forget about what you like. Focus on what's available. Get yourself hired. Show up early. Stay late. Volunteer for the scut work. Become indispensable. You can always quit later and be no worse off than you are today. But don't waste another year looking for a career that doesn't exist. And most of all, stop worrying about your happiness. Happiness does not come from a job. It comes from knowing what you truly value and behaving in a way that's consistent with those values. Many people today resent the suggestion that they're in charge of the way they feel. But trust me, those people are mistaken. This was a big lesson I learned from dirty jobs, and I learned it several hundred times before it stuck. What you do, who you're with, and how you feel about the world around you is completely up to you. Isn't that interesting? Mike, thanks for that bit of advice. You know, this is sort of what I'm going to call the working man's advice on learning to love your job. Well, that was interesting, but I wanted to take another perspective at it. So let's take a look at the academic or the scholarly approach by Cal Newport in his book, So Good They Can't Ignore You. Now, Cal is a researcher. He's got a lot of degrees. He has written a number of books. He has a great blog called Study Hacks that he started when he was, I believe, at MIT on how to study and have lots of free time and get good grades. And it sort of expanded as he left school. It now has become a blog that really addresses almost anything that he's currently interested in. Well, Cal does a great job of stating his theory and then reinforcing it with extensive interviews and research on both well-known individuals and some we may not have heard of before. He says, why is follow your passion not good advice? And he traces it back, and he did this. It was kind of interesting. He did this through a Google search. Apparently, there's a way to search how often a phrase or word is used. And he really traces it back and says, follow your passion really started in terms of popularity on the internet in 2005, immediately following a commencement address by Steve Jobs. And in that address, Jobs had said, you've got to find what you love. The only way to do great work is to love what you do. And if you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle. Well, that kind of got paraphrased in the media to follow your passion, you know? And it was sort of this hypothesis that said that the key to occupational happiness is to first figure out what you're passionate about and then go find a job that matches this passion. You know, does any of this sound familiar? You know, I don't know. I coach some of the Gen X and Gen Ys, and I coach some of the baby boomers and before, and the issue all seems to sort of be the same, you know, that everybody's sort of struggling with this, well, I don't know what my passion is. How do I find my passion? And if you really want to know, you can go to any of the self-help sections in the library or the bookstore, and, you know, they're full of books talking about this. Well, Cal's research found few examples that prove this theory that your occupational happiness had to do with first finding out what you're passionate about and then finding a job that matches that. What he did find was that passion is a side effect of mastery of a job. In fact, studies showed that motivation or happiness in the workplace requires that you fulfill three basic needs, as he spells them out. And those three needs are autonomy, the feeling that you have control over your day and that your actions are important. Competence, the feeling that you're good at what you do. And relatedness, the feeling of connection to other people. Those were the things that had more to do with identifying whether you were happy in your job or with your work than whether it related to some passion that you had. This led Cal to sort of state that working right trumps finding the right work. Let me read that once again. It's kind of interesting. Working right trumps finding the right work. You know, if you read, go back to Mike Rowe for a minute, if you read his blog about the hundreds of people that he's interviewed on the program Dirty Jobs, he really supports this. He gives many examples of people that are happy with the work, but doing work that basically is unappealing. I mean, unappealing is an understatement. Most of the things he does on that show, you and I don't ever want to do. However, what the people that he's interviewed that are happy with their job, they have somehow achieved all three of those needs that we just talked about, which far outweighs the intrinsic value of the task itself or whether it relates to passion. In fact, Cal Newport goes on and says, follow your passion might not only not be good advice, it might probably be bad advice for many people. Well, that one really got me. It's one thing to say it's not good advice. It's another thing to say, and not only that, it might hurt you. So, you know, what is he talking about that? You know, and I begin to think about how many times I've had this coaching discussion with clients about what they're passionate about, only to see a blank look on their face when I ask that question. And it gets even worse if I qualify the question and say, what are you passionate about doing that you can make a living at? Now, you know, there's exceptions to every rule and to every story. And, you know, we all want to think about the doctor or the lawyer or the child that grew up wanting to be a ballet dancer or a movie star, and they knew it from the time they came out of the crib and they were passionate about it, and they went on in life and that's what they did. And those people are out there, and man, I applaud them and I'm envious of them. Because the rest of us don't really have that. The rest of us, when I ask my clients, what are you passionate about? They might say something like, well, building model airplanes, playing ball with the kids, soccer, the Angels, their favorite football team. Very seldom does the answer have anything to do with the work setting that they're really in. So, in fact, the more people have bought into this idea that my happiness depends on my identifying what I'm first passionate about, which that's a chore, and then finding a job that lets me do nothing but what I'm passionate about, and that's pretty much an impossibility. If those things don't work, or they aren't practical, or they don't work for the majority of us, what we end up with is people that are very unhappy because they're pursuing a goal that's not achievable. And of course, we all know that the key to goal setting is to identify a goal that is truly achievable. It's okay if it's a stretch goal. You're going to have to work a little bit at it, that it's not easy to get there. But hey, it would be silly for me to say, you know, I'm passionate about playing basketball and I want to be on the Lakers team. Well, come on, I'm not tall enough, I'm not coordinated enough, and at this point I'm too old. That's not going to happen. So it would be a ridiculous thing to say, okay, I know what I'm passionate about. It's basketball and playing for the Lakers, and I'm going to pursue that. That doesn't happen. So Cal talks about two alternative approaches in terms of ways to think about your work. The one we've kind of talked about, which is the passion mindset. And it sort of focuses on what value your job offers you. What does the world offer you? And this attitude, as we've said, almost guarantees you're going to be unhappy because it creates a focus on what you don't like about the job. You know, you think about this attitude for entry-level positions, people just coming into the workforce, or people being retrained, having to come back into the workforce, or people doing menial service positions. I mean, who's going to be passionate about those kinds of things? And how many of us know what we're passionate about, especially if the response is supposed to stand the test of time and not be a fad or a passing fancy? Newport outlines an alternative mindset for thinking about your work, what he calls the craftsman mindset. And this really appealed to me. It's a focus on what value you're producing in your job versus the passion mindset, which is what value your job is giving you. So it's, what do you offer the world through doing this job? You know, this is the attitude that Mike Rowe talked about in the blog post that we started the show with. It says, put your head down, work hard, get so good they can't ignore you. You don't have to love your job today to embrace this attitude. But over time, you'll be able to achieve those three basic needs we talked about earlier, and as a result, end up loving your job if you develop a mastery of the job that you're doing. And you only develop that mastery through hard work. Doing great work requires traits that are rare and valuable. You know, Malcolm Gladwell in one of his books says that this is not limited to natural talent, but instead it's about being in the right place at the right time to accumulate such a massive amount of practice. Now, you know that, let's just look at that. We've all heard the stage that, well, you were successful because you were in the right place at the right time, and that's sort of like luck is really what this is all about. That's not what Gladwell is talking about. He says be in the right place at the right time to allow you to accumulate a massive amount of practice. What does he mean there? He refers to what's known, and I had never heard of this before, what's known as the 10,000-hour rule. Now, apparently, this is a rule that for performers, musicians, people that are in the performing arts, it's a very well-known rule, readily acceptable. And Cal Newport goes on to make a lot of really valid arguments about the fact that this rule is equally valid in the knowledge society that we are working in. What that rule says is the idea that excellence at performing a complex task requires a critical minimum level of practice surface again and again in studies of expertise. In fact, researchers have settled on what they believe is the magic number for true expertise, 10,000 hours. Now, this does not mean that you just show up and work hard for 10,000 hours. You know, and Cal really devotes a lot of his book to really make it clear that you have to put in dedicated, deliberate practice. You know, it sort of reminds me when I was back in junior high school or earlier, we lived near a recreation center, and I really wanted to learn to play tennis. And I had a tennis racket, and I had a bunch of balls, but I didn't have anybody to play with. So there was some outdoor handball courts next to the tennis courts that nobody ever used. And I would hop the fence, and I would go over there, and I would hit this ball against that racquetball concrete wall for hours and hours and hours, working on my forehand, working on my backhand, trying to work on a serve. I put in a lot of hours of practice. You know, and what is it that they say? What does practice? Practice make perfect? No. Practice makes what you're doing. You perfect the errors that you've got. And I later on in life, when I took my first set of tennis lessons, found that I was holding the racket wrong. I was swinging wrong on the backhand. Everything I was doing was wrong. And boy, was it hard to relearn it, to change it, because I had practiced all those hours doing it wrong. So what we're talking about here is dedicated, deliberate practice. This is an all-out effort of focus and concentration, and it's about getting incrementally better over time. Cal Newport calls this deep work and suggests the following study guidelines for this. If you're going to do this level of deep work, put in your 10,000 hours to get good at producing radio shows, or get good at closing the books in the accounting office, whatever it is you're doing, the first thing he suggests is a time blocking exercise. And, you know, it's funny how the more you read things, the more they sort of reinforce other things that you're reading. And I recently spent a whole lot of time reading articles about how you have to set your priorities first. Now, that sort of didn't make sense to me. Priorities, that's sort of doing it first anyhow. But what this author was talking about was that first thing in the day, you work on setting your priorities for what you're going to do that day. And he took an amazing amount of time. And Cal Newport talks about the fact that very seldom can it take him less than an hour to figure out what he's going to work on for that day, that he time blocks out that day and the rest of the week. And he tracks the hours that he's putting in on the tasks that he's blocked out. He believes in this 10,000 hour rule, and he is tracking how many hours am I really putting in. It's not just that I opened the book and looked at it. It's not just that I picked up the guitar and strummed a few chords. It's that I worked on those scales for 55 minutes this morning and 55 minutes this afternoon, or whatever it is. So number one, to do this level of deep work, to really develop mastery of your work, is time blocking. The second point, which we all know but we tend to ignore, is develop systems, habits, and rituals. So, you know, unfortunately, how many of you have the habit that the first thing you do when you get to your office or your workspace and turn on your computer, you're waiting for it, is you check your email? Now, everything I've ever read says that, you know, your ability to handle complex thoughts, to handle abstract ideas, to be creative, diminishes as the day goes on, and diminishes as you sit there and work. So the first thing you should be doing is those kinds of creative, those kinds of tasks that require your brain. Email does not require a whole lot of brain work. It does not. We can, you know, I have been working for the last 2 weeks, not quite 2 weeks, on, I can't break the habit of checking my email first, okay? I know there's a crisis out there. Somebody's got $1 million for me, or they want to hire me for $1 million. So, you know, I open up that email folder, and I quickly, now this is new, I quickly scan it to see, is there anything from any of my clients? Is there anything from anybody that I had an urgent request out to? And if there is, I'll read those one or two things, and the rest of it, I wait till later in the day to look at. All the while wondering what I'm missing. You know, did Apple come out with a new computer? You know, is there something free they're giving away on the internet? I know. But I'm starting to change my habit, and I'm finding okay, I can get through those emails in about 10 minutes, you know, 100, 150 emails. Only 5 to 10 of them are really critical to handle right away, and they don't take much time. The next thing, and the third thing in this deep work philosophy to get to mastery of what you're doing, is focus. And we've talked about that in the past. You know, we are a multitasking society. We pretend that we're proud of it. And there isn't a scientist around that will substantiate the fact that we are effective at multitasking. I listened earlier today to a seminar on neuroscience, talking about the prefrontal cortex and how the brain works and how you're only able to hold, some people say, 7 ideas in your mind at one time with any kind of accuracy, but really they're saying 4, and if you want to do it well, 1 or 2. And here we are trying to mentally juggle 25 things in our head that we're kind of holding. It doesn't work, folks. It doesn't work at all. Training your mind is training yourself to focus on one thing at a time. Whether it's for 10 minutes, whether it's for 30 minutes, whether it's for 2 hours, now we're stretching it. Not many of us have the ability to focus for that long. But that's what it's all about. I have a couple of favorite authors that I read a lot of fiction. And one of them, I was interested to find out that he's a prolific writer. And he leaves his house, and he's got a, what would he call it, a studio that's detached from the house. And he goes to work every morning, 15 steps over to the studio. Nobody comes into the studio. That's his area. He sits down, and he sits there, and he writes till noon every day. And if he can't write anything, he still sits there thinking about why he can't write anything. In other words, sitting there and saying, oh, I'm not very creative today, I think I'll go fishing, is not an out. He has over time trained his mind that when he walks into this environment, the focus is all on the book that he's writing. The focus is all on, I'm not going to think about what I'm going to do this afternoon. I'm not going to think about, can I rush through this and go do something else? I am here for till noon because that is my routine. As a result, this guy turns out, I mean, I don't remember the number, but I just couldn't believe how many books he turns out a year. And these are good. Well, I think they're good quality. Let's put it this way. He sells a lot of books. Okay. So again, what Newport says is when you start this, you know, think about 10 minute, 20 minute segments of focus. You really think you could sit down and focus for 2 hours, but if you really kind of observe yourself, you're going to find that after 10 or 15 minutes, you're not really staying focused. So, you know, give it a shot. Next week, 15 minutes of focus. The week after, add 5 more minutes. The week after, 5 more minutes. Build yourself up slowly. It's like weight training, only for your mind. You know, you don't go in and start pumping 200-pound weights. You go in and you start with lighter weights. You build up repetitions. You add a couple of pounds. You add a couple of pounds. You do this slowly. If you try to do it too fast, you injure something. You give up. You say, this doesn't work for me. I wasn't built for weightlifting. Same thing with focusing for your mind. You have to do this up. All of this is really geared around whatever the job is. Forget about whether you're passionate about it. Whatever the job is, devote yourself to the job to develop a mastery of the tasks that you're working on so that you can build up what Newport calls career capital. Career capital is the idea that I've worked here for 2 years and the boss knows I am the best at doing this job of anybody around here. And so now when I go into him and tell him, you know, I'd like a little more autonomy. I don't feel like coming in every day. I can work one day a week from home. Now, the new guy asking for that gets fired. But, you know, but if you've been there for a while and you've developed the mastery of the job, you have this career capital that gives you credibility. So when you go in and they go, well, you know, I really don't like you not being here, but you're so good at what you do. I guess you not being here is the lesser of two evils. I certainly don't want to lose you. And it goes on like this. So you start to build up the ability to have this autonomy. You start to build up the ability to have a little more control over what it is you do. You build up the ability to negotiate with who you're working with and when you're working and what the environment is like. All of that is to develop this mastery, which goes back to the beginning of Mike Rowe saying, hey, stop worrying about your passion. Put your head down. Get to work. Get good at what you're doing. And you know what? When you're good, I have never met anybody who was good at something that they didn't enjoy it. There is a satisfaction out of knowing you are good at this. Now, you know, before we wrap up here in a few minutes, there are some situations where this craftsman mindset will not work. So let's just get those on the table. If you are in a job that offers few opportunities to distinguish yourself by developing relevant skills, then it doesn't work. So, you know, this is a job that you're on an assembly line, you pick up the tire, you put it on the car, and that's it. Or if the job focuses on something that you think is useless or perhaps even bad for the world. So if you have no respect for what you're doing, I'm not saying you don't like it. I mean, I've had accounting jobs early in my career. I didn't particularly like running the machine, but over time when I got good at it, hey, it was a lot of fun to be acknowledged as good at closing the books or as good at analyzing the financial statements. And the third thing is, if the job forces you to work with people you really dislike, then this job, if any one of those three things is there, it is not going to work for this craftsman mindset. What does that mean? You probably ought to look for a different job. You probably ought to look for a different job because you're not going to find real happiness in your work environment. Or if you're the kind of person that can say happiness in my work environment isn't important, okay. You know, I don't have that. Now, let me just say as we get ready to close here, you know, that I've referenced the work today of two very talented authors, Mike Rowe and Cal Newport. Now, I want to be clear that none of this discussion is a substitute for reading their works. And my purpose was to make you rethink this popular theory that says follow your passion is going to make you happy. And in so doing, I've kind of given you my interpretation of what I've read from these two authors, which is probably not the same as what the authors meant to say. It's just my interpretation. I'm personally still not clear on how I'm going to use this information other than to be more careful in my coaching when I talk to people about follow your passion. I don't think I can go meet with anybody ever again and say, well, you don't like what you're doing? Well, what are you passionate about? Let's follow your passion. I think we want to talk about what are you good at? What do you do that you feel gives to the world, that has value to other people, that people are willing to pay you for? Those are the things that are critical. So that's kind of it for today. I want to just leave you hopefully feeling a little uncomfortable with the idea of following your passion. Maybe you'll be uncomfortable enough to do a little more research and think about what is the substitute theorem and how do you work with this. I think both Mike Rowe and Cal Newport have got some great ideas for that. So I want to say, you know, we've been coaching here in Orange County, the Coaching Perspective, for 20 years now. We do executive business coaching, what I sometimes refer to as coach-sulting, sort of a combination of coaching and consulting. I prefer to do the coaching, but sometimes the consulting edges its way into that. But we work primarily with teams, with management teams, and we like to work with people that are interested in improving their performance and developing what we've talked about today and developing a mastery in what they do, whether that be a technical skill or whether it be a management skill, whether it be a communication skill. We're all about helping you to master things that are going to give you true happiness in your job. So thank you very much for listening to us today. Thank you for your support in our radio program. Hope you enjoyed the show. Hope the discussion has provided with you new ideas and information that you can use immediately to identify and achieve your goals. Have a great evening.
You've been listening to the one show that takes a look at business from a different perspective, the coaching perspective, with Master Certified Business Coach, Doug Gefeller.